gentlemen, boys and girls, Dying Time is here. That's right. It's Friday the 13th, the final chapter of Kill by Kill. Greetings and salutations, Internet. It's your old pal, Patrick Hamilton, coming to you from Camp Crystal Lake, or as close to it as I could possibly get. We're back with another edition of the Kill by Kill podcast, where we discuss the least celebrated component of any horror film, the characters, and we will be unpacking all the gory details of every hack, slash, and decapitation in the hopes that a camper's untimely end is just the beginning of the jokes that we can make about them. And as always, the person who helps me through the dark, scary night of Camp Crystal Lake is the one and only Gina Radcliffe. How you doing, Gina?
I'm good, Patrick. I'm happy to be talking with you after our little break, our hiatus. Lots happened since we last recorded.
Oh no, nothing of note that I can think of.
I wrote a couple things down. I wrote Doctor Strange came out. Did you see Doctor Strange? That was pretty cool. Oh
yeah, yeah, it was. It was awesome.
We got a shout out from our friends at the Flophouse.
Oh, that was nice. Yeah.
Westworld wrapped up. I still haven't finished that yet, but I'm going to.
It's a real mind bender. Yeah.
I understand it. It's just gonna blow my brain right through my fucking hat. and we had a presidential election, and now everything is terrible.
Oh yeah.
The skies are blood and the rivers run brown with diarrhea.
That's very vivid and specific, and you're not wrong at all, unfortunately. I think this is one of those situations where we just have to hold on tight to the ones we love and those that we see floating by that desperately need our help. We have to, like a Mrs. Voorhees, reach out and grab that person and yank them into the Jeep and help people who need help.
Well, nothing else. I'll just distract myself through whatever horrors to come by talking about fake horror.
That's right. I think that's the best way to go about this, at least for the time that we have together, the moments that we all share through this audio podcast, I hope are relief for people who might feel stress and might feel scared and uneasy. There's a lot to feel about those things, especially with the condition of the world. But I promise you, for the time that we have, we will try to keep things light and fun. And boy, howdy, our guest today probably has more experience with one of the people that we're going to talk about today than either of us, obviously, because we never met the man. It is the director of such films as The Attic Expeditions, The Thirst, and of course, the incredible remake of The Wizard of Gore. It's the one and only Jeremy Kasdan. How are you doing, sir?
I am fantastic, guys. I'm really excited to be with you. I am!
So
no, I really
much.
Am. I actually am really excited.
Now, Jeremy is one of my oldest LA friends that I met through my wife through the incredible Emerson College connection. And Jeremy, I think it took about 5 or 6 years before someone in our little cabal said, "Oh, you like horror films? Do you know that Jeremy, like, directs horror films?"
I know, that's really odd, because we'd hung out a lot doing very not horror film like things.
Yes.
And of course, we actually have a much deeper connection than I have with most other people I ever interface with from Emerson, which is, you know, a love of seeing people brutally murdered.
Yeah, as a way to bring people together. Now, as our tradition here at the Kill by Kill podcast, we always ask our guests, what was your first experience with the Friday the 13th franchise?
Well, good question. I'll keep it short, but to make it as uncomplicated as possible, as a reader of Mad and Cracked magazine growing up, there was no way. There were a lot of movies that I felt like I'd seen because I obsessively read their satires in Mad magazine, and so the Friday the 13th movies were movies that I was pretty sure that I'd seen, even though I hadn't. So I felt like I could, like, talk about them with some authority when I was, you know, 9, even though, of course, I hadn't seen them at all. And to be totally honest, this is the first time that I've seen this film, the Friday the 13th, number 4.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
We have two virgins in a row.
Isn't that weird?
Oh, no, it's not that weird. I think it's one of those things where you either missed or you didn't. I was the same way when it comes to films that you read about before you saw them. In particular, through Mad Magazine, Alien. Like, yes. I knew every beat of Alien,
yeah.
But only because I had just pored over those 6 or 7 pages.
And they were Mad still Magazine. Creepy. That's what's fucking crazy. Can I curse on this show?
Yes. Shit, yeah.
Okay, good. I remember looking at the mat, because I had seen Alien way too young, and not to get off topic, but I remember looking at the magazine, at the Mad Magazine version, creeped out by that, because there was stuff that you couldn't see in the movie. It was so dark and it moved so fast. And you could really look at the creatures in the magazine and fuck yourself all up, getting nervous about looking at, you know, cartoons that were making fun of them because they were pooping or whatever else. But yeah, so that's really, I remember being very aware of the franchise and also lying and speaking authoritatively on playgrounds about them as though I'd seen them all, the way you do when you're a kid, where you tell people what happens in the movie and you're just making it up and, you know, all that.
I distinctly remember something akin to that that happened to me, where one kid had sworn up and down he had seen Carrie, De Palma's Carrie.
Yeah.
And we're like, whoa, would you tell us all about it? And he began describing this movie where a person had psychic powers and he could move objects and things would explode. And then there was one part where a guy with glasses on, his head just explodes. And it was years later that I discovered, no, he was talking about Scanners. He had seen Scanners. I mean, 6 1/2 dozen the other.
I mean, that's still pretty impressive that the kid had seen Scanners, let's face it. I mean, you know, in a way, more cool that he'd seen a Cronenberg film so young.
So let's get right into it. And just to catch everyone up at home, who maybe they're listening to the Kill by Kill podcast for the first time, to who's alive at this point. First up is Tommy Jarvis. He's a bull haircut suspended 5 feet off the ground. And then you have his sister, Trish. Now, Trish is the kind of girl who jogs in a sweater. You know the type. Ted, who happens to be just one fedora away from constantly shouting m'lady at women who can't stand his presence. And then we have Doug. And Doug is a guy, he is so beautiful that no one points and laughs at him when you see him with a polo shirt tucked into micro shorts. We didn't have Sarah, and Sarah is an individual that we know for sure isn't a robot because she gets wet and she doesn't explode. Otherwise, you might not be able to tell. And then we have Rob, our shitty monster hunter, who has decided to seek and destroy Jason Voorhees, armed only with a boot knife and a flimsy deer rifle. And that brings us to the three characters that we'll be discussing tonight. And we're going to start off with Mrs. Jarvis, the woman with no first name.
She's the even less essential character than the hitchhiker, despite having more screen time and more dialogue.
That's very, very true. Most of her dialogue is communicated in a sort of French neo-realistic silent play sort of
thing. Well, she's actually given signs. She doesn't, they did not want to pay her any SAG rate at all. So they just said, she needs to say, fuck you, put it on a sign. That's fine. There's your 30 bucks, sweetie. Enjoy your banana.
Here's your costume of dirty blue clothing. And there you go. So, yeah, we got Mrs. Jarvis. I can only assume that maybe Mrs. Jarvis lost her first name in the divorce.
Well, it's something like Janet or Donna or Nancy, that like middle-aged 80s mom name, Joanne.
it's whatever the name of the mom is on oh, I blew the joke too. Now I wish I was, yeah. All right, I'm going to go, guys.
Bye, it's been great. Good night, everybody.
Family ties, that's it.
You know, I'm just going to edit those things together so that it comes right up to, you know, that mom, family ties, and no one will ever know. They just assume you were very, very happy about saying family ties. Yeah, poor Mrs. J. That's how I'm going to refer to her because I enjoy Happy Days in the abstract. We meet Mrs. J running around the lake with her daughter, Trish. And we have a bit of dialogue here that I wanted to point out. Trish notes that she thinks that her mom is lonely. And then, oh no, Trish says that Mr. J, a man with no name, is actually lonely. And then asks about, oh my God, why is this so fucking hard to say? Trish is a daughter of, this is why people are given first names, Gina. Why do I have to talk about this in fucking code? Mom Jarvis.
Perfect.
Is running with daughter Jarvis.
Oh, wait. Yes. Let's interrupt. The wiki gives her a first name.
Holy really? Shit.
It, wow. She is listed as Tracy Jarvis. Although, going by the... Now, again, I should point out that the wiki is fan written. This is not necessarily canon. Uh-huh. And I am dubious that they give her birth year, and which would make her 64 years old.
Oh, fuck you. Fuck you. She is a very lovely woman for 64 years old.
No kidding. Wow. And she her, no wonder she's in that sweater when she's jogging. It's going to get very, very cold out there.
Her birth year is listed as 1920.
Oh, fuck you.
Wow.
So anyways, they run around, and at one point Trish turns to her and she says, I think you're getting horny. My question to either of you is, when was the last time you asked your mom if you thought she was getting horny?
Probably the last time I had a sit up in my bed soaked in sweat nightmare, maybe.
Oh, that's weird. Yeah, I mean, I hadn't really thought about it, but you know, my mom and I stopped talking about that when we stopped going for jogs together. that's a good point.
You lost that bonding moment.
It was a running together thing, I guess.
No, I would sooner really throw myself out of a second story window than ask my mom or accuse my mom of being horny. No, thank you. Mrs. J, you know, fans of bad costuming, and certainly we are because we watched every Friday the 13th movie up until this point, have noted that Mrs. J's sweatsuit is an odd piece of clothing. It's baggy where it should be tight and tight where it should be baggy. It's not doing her any favors, but also, like all the other kids, we notice she is not wearing underwear.
Yeah.
Why didn't the costumer provide underwear, or did Chuck Zito tell everyone, when you show up to set, I don't want to see underwear.
No underpants. No underpants on my set.
Yeah, underwear seem to be missing a lot. Like the scene where they go skinny dipping.
Yeah.
No one's wearing underwear. I think Jimmy was like the only person that was wearing underwear, but the girl, no bras. No boxers, nothing. Everybody was sans culottes, no underwear.
That's true. That is true. And the only reason Jimmy is for comedy. I think the suggestion is, you know, boy, look at this goofball. He wears underpants under his pants.
Not only is he wearing underpants, he's wearing boxer shorts back when that used to be a sign that you were kind of a stodgy old man.
Well, Jimmy's costume in this is perplexing. In a number of ways, and everyone's is, because they're wearing basically winter or early spring or late fall gear in the middle of ostensibly the summer.
Because I noticed only that.
Only a few days have passed since part two, and only a few days have passed since part three. All of these movies have occurred in the summer. So why is he walking around like an Amish dissident with his long sleeve button down shirt buttoned all the way to the top?
Well, clearly he was afraid of ticks.
That is a legitimate fear.
His kids were very wise about Lyme disease even back then, and I appreciate that.
From the mouths of babes, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Let's get back to Mrs. Jarvis. And we have to make a very moral quandary-esque decision here. I am wondering if perhaps child services should be called. And you maybe think, oh, that's because she's moved her two vulnerable children to a town that is constantly seeing murderous rampages. No. My problem is she serves tuna salad with orange juice. No one in their right fucking mind combines tuna salad with an acidic juice. And Trish seems particularly addicted to the stuff. She is drinking lemonade. She is drinking orange juice. She is pounding juice. And I fear for her teeth.
I feel like she might be raising them in a sort of like dog tooth situation because they don't know anything about this mass murder that took place down the road. They're just completely, what? 15 people were killed just half a mile away from here?
Trish has seen the headlines. I mean, granted, they've been upside down from when her mom's reading the newspaper, but one would feel that you might piece together the idea that many, many dead bodies have shown up at the lake where you live is kind of like, hey, let's keep doing our, you know, weekly morning runs. What do we have to fear? I would say the mutant backwoods ninja who keeps killing people. When Tommy and Trish go outside to meet the dead meat gang, that's when they arrive. Mrs. J looks out the window at them like she's fully aware that their presence might bring Jason on to their side of the lake. She peers at them with a lot of like, oh, fuck. Now, is that dread that Trish is going to get wrapped up in their hijinks or that Tommy's going to get wrapped up in their hijinks?
Oh, I think it's both. I mean, you know, Tommy already was, you know, peeping on them, skinny dipping earlier. I think, you know, she's not ready for her little boy to enter to enter manhood just yet.
We got a long way to go before that kid enters manhood. That road sign is not near.
I don't know. He is a changed young man at the end of the movie. We'll get to that in another episode, but still.
That's true. So let's get right to Mrs. J's death, because there's not much else to talk about her. I literally had three fucking notes. Mrs. J comes back from her second run of the day, because why not? She has a lot of horniness to disperse through sweat, I suppose.
True.
There are worse ways to do it. She comes back into the house, and these are the words that she says at the top of her lungs. I'm going to towel off and then I'm going to strangle you. To no one in particular, what does this mean? Is she mad because the door was left open before? But we know the door wasn't left open because she opens it. So what the fuck is she going to strangle people about?
Yeah, I feel like there was definitely a deleted scene in there. Maybe she found, I don't know, Is it raining at this point? Yeah, I guess it is. So maybe someone tracked in rain and they cut out the single half a second shot that would have established wet footprints or something all over the floor.
I love that you had a whole story about that. Yeah, I like that. I'll take the wet footprints for sure. I just thought that's what she always says to her kids.
Like some people say, honey, I am home. And she says, I'm going to towel off and I'm going to strangle you.
Right. I didn't assume that she was actually going to wipe her body down with a towel. I just thought that's what she says.
It's fair enough. Yeah, Mrs. Chait's got, in addition to a bad costume, her hairstyle leaves something to be desired. And she's not alone. I have the feeling that the hairstylist on the set had like two moves. And that's body wave or awkwardly placed bun. Because the twins also have the awkwardly placed bun, and then most of the other girls just have body waves, whereas Mrs. J looks like she's heading to an audition for the stepmother in Disney's Cinderella.
It reminds me of that, what's it called, felting, that arts and crafts thing where people make felt creatures out of, you know, lint or dryer lint or whatever it is. It definitely
Gina
has
Radcliffe?
A felt...
Yes, no, I know what he's talking about. You, and it would be appropriate for this type of movie because it involves just taking a piece of wool and just repeatedly stabbing it.
Stabbing it. Yeah, exactly. Yes, that's it.
Oh, see? Thank you.
It'd be a wonderful craft for Jason to take up to direct his murderous rage towards.
Agreed. Absolutely. And also, he'd be able to do craft fairs and make friends.
Because I could really use a friend.
I mean, let's say you're at the Crystal Lake swap meet. Or are we going to say this is a farmer's market?
No, it's a swap meet.
It's a swap meet?
Yeah, in the Pine Barrens of New Jersey, it's a swap meet.
New Jersey's more of a swap meet sort of state.
Yeah.
For sure. Give you that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you wander in and you notice a booth. Behind it is a rather muddy fellow with a hockey mask. Selling felting wares, and my guess is What is he selling those for, or is it like a trade sitch?
Well, I mean, he's probably selling them for food. Maybe a new tarp to cover his shelter.
Tarp's a great idea. Yeah, absolutely. But I would be much more curious what kind of things is he making, like little dragons? Are they chickadees? Or what kind of stuff? Or just potholders and that sort of thing?
They're all potholders with pictures of his mom, some coasters.
The pictures of his mom.
Yep.
You know, sort of little paper doll-like things where you put a corpse juice-laden sweater on top of his mom.
Yeah.
I get the impression he makes a lot of those dried apple dolls. Do you remember making those in school where you would...
Kitchen witches.
Exactly, yes. they all just inadvertently look like his mom at the end of part two.
Sure.
Because all dried apple dolls look like the mom. It looked like Mrs. Voorhees at the end of part two.
Delicious.
What does he use for hair?
Maybe that's what happened to his hair in part two. He cut it all off and...
His beautiful hair. Can I tell a quick story? Once upon a time, I was Mormon. All right, that's it. No, I was Mormon and I went on a mission, as you're supposed to do, and everyone else was doing it, so I did. And I was shipped off to New Jersey, strangely enough. Yeah, I was introduced to a woman who lived in the apartment building next to ours, who the missionaries constantly visited in the hopes that she would have some sort of, you know, religious epiphany. But really what I discovered is that she cut off her own hair to stuff dolls.
Wow.
So she was half bald in patches because she would take it off in patches and then lay off her remaining hair over top of it. But to stuff the dolls, not even to put as the doll's hair,
right?
But the stuffing.
It's inside. Yeah.
The inside, like you can get things for the inside.
not that feel like that. Not that have that feeling of real human hair stuffed dolls.
Oh.
Believe me, I've been collecting for a long time and they're just very special.
Oh man, when you get that real hair stuffed doll feeling, you never go back.
Yeah, that's right.
I got a book for Christmas last year called Crafting with Cat Hair, and I sort of feel like the person that gave it to me was poking gentle fun at my my several hundred crafts and interests, and I thought, well, this is kind of creepy, but stuffing dolls with your own hair, I mean, that's like Stephen King's short story territory right there.
For sure.
Yeah. So very quickly, because Mrs. Jarvis's death is unceremonious. I mean, she just
kind of disappears. I said, even the hitchhiker for her trouble got an on-screen death.
Yeah. Before she goes, though, there is one thing to note. She asks 13 questions to know what. 13. I counted. It just keeps asking. She asks about the dog. She asks where Tommy is. She asks where Trish is. She asks what's going on. She asks what she's doing. She asks where the dog is. She asks where the dog is again. She asks if she's crazy. And then she looks up and she's gone. RIPD, Mrs. Jarvis, we think.
She just wandered into the woods just asking questions. It's sort of a form of epilepsy where she just starts going off on a tangent, just, you know, where's the dog? What day is it? When's lunch? And then just sort of wanders away. And then normally it's the kids' job to kind of gently steer her back to the couch and sit her down, but they're off doing whatever.
Amazing.
So let us move on to the main event. This is probably what we've been leading up to for all of our episodes, is to talk about Jimmy. And just to set this up, for you, Jeremy, in a previous episode, I described Jimmy as a person full of as much quirk and youthful exuberance as he is Crispin fucking Glover.
Yeah.
And you have the most experience with Crispin Glover of anyone currently talking in this podcast because you directed him in a movie.
That's right.
How did that happen?
You know, because I'm the luckiest guy in the world, I think. I was remaking the Herschel Gordon Lewis Wizard of Gore, which is a famously terrible, you know, predating the slasher films. Herschel Gordon Lewis made the first gory horror movies, but they were horrible. And I discovered them because I'm from Baltimore and John Waters was a huge fan. Before he made any movies, he was obsessed with these incredibly trashy, terrible films that, that Herschel Gordon Lewis made, where people can't act and the sets all look like they're, you know, shot in the suburbs in the mid-60s in Miami. And there's lots of like cow tongues and really, really bright red blood and Kodachrome film. And they're wonderful and terrible. And Crispin, luckily, somehow decided that he was obsessed or equally obsessed with playing the role that I had envisioned him playing. So it wasn't because he thought that I was, you know, going to be a brilliant filmmaker. And it wasn't because he thought this movie is ripe for remaking and this guy's got a vision. It was just because he thought it would be fun to play that role. And, you know, it's a very chewing the scenery kind of role. So it was perfect for him. And I think he just knew that out the gate.
I mean, he is, not to put too fine a point on it, a highlight of that particular film. He is the tide that lifts all boats in that particular film. And I think you set him up very well. Top of it, the film is dripping with style and voice, and he just happens to fit into it. Now, he, of course, has been famous for being quirky both on screen and off. The rumor on this particular film was, and let me quickly grab my notes on this so I don't get this wrong, is that when he was asked to come to set at one point, he responded, "No, I'm feeling like a rain day today."
Oh, on The Wizard of Gore?
No, on Friday the 13th, Part 4. Yes.
Oh, wow. He was already Crispin Glover enough by this movie.
That I think he was born Crispin Glover.
Yeah, I guess so. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, he. I actually, for my TV blog, I reviewed a show he was in before Friday the 13th, in which he was supposed to be just this regular, normal teenage boy, and just the quirks and the tics. I mean, he could not. it's like, I'm not buying this guy as a normal middle-class teenager. I mean, he looks like he just is about to explode.
Yeah.
Because he's trying to rein it in, and he's literally just kind of like, he doesn't stop moving for a second. He's talking, he breaks the fourth wall a lot, and like, he fidgets and moves his hands around so much that it made me nervous to watch him. And I wasn't, this was on like YouTube. I can't imagine what it would be like to be next to him. But he was trying, and he was trying to be normal.
I'm sure there's somebody standing right off the camera saying, just please, just tone it down, Crispin. I mean, there's a couple things that I just loved in this movie, but he has a line where he just says, "God, I'm horny." And given to any other teenage boy, they would just say, "God, I'm horny," and seem to know what horny means, and it wouldn't have all this weird subtext. When he says it, you think he might want to eat the head of a rat. Like, and it's subtle. You don't really, but you just, and then it's like compounded by the fact that, like, you know, he actually is really believes what he says because it's Crispin Glover and everything's with conviction. And then you think, oh, right, that's Crispin Glover and the idea of him being horny and what that means, what kind of icky thing that means inside his head. It's just wonderful. And so much more loaded than I think anybody intended at that moment, you know, 16 minutes into this movie. It's great.
I have a couple of my favorites of his lines from this. One is his line reading of, "Oh, nah, we have no suits." Which, there's only so many words in that sentence, and yet he seems to draw all of them out and add additional syllables to them that are unnecessary. Another one is when he and Tina finally make it up to Paul and Samantha's room, and she pushes him down on the bed, and he looks around and goes, "Oh, yeah, this is a neat room."
Agreed, I had that neat room. Wonderful. It really is. Yeah. Yeah. And the primary feature of that room is images of dogs at the hunt, which is really my favorite thing going on. I'm not sure what the message is from the production designer. I know there's a joke in there. I just can't quite get at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think my favorite line reading, I think I've mentioned in the last episode, but when he is trying to get Tina to dance with him, so he walks up to her and he's like, "Do you want to dance?" And she's like, to this? And he's like, he pauses just for a second, like he's thinking. It's almost like the Terminator when he's trying to determine what the correct answer should be. And then he just says, it's good. It's like, what?
Yeah.
What's good? You know, because it's not that song, I can tell you that. But and then she gets up and dances with them. She's into this potential, you know, he might skin me and wear me as a suit later act. She's into it.
I mean, he's at his most peaches and creamiest in terms of, he looks like, if you could get as close to him being in a sort of John Hughes movie, yep, this is as close to it as he will ever get.
Absolutely.
And so in terms of like wholesome boy next door-ish, if he doesn't open his mouth, he's there.
Yeah.
Once he does or moves his body, things begin to mutate. For example, here's something I caught just this particular run through of the movie. And that is, once Paul rejects Tina because of hat shenanigans, I'm not particularly sure. His whole motivation is a mystery to me. The camera pans back and we find Jimmy on the couch, despondently making a mobile out of Cheetos and toothpicks.
Mm-hmm. Once you said the thing about Crispin saying he needed a rain day, I knew that is it. That mobile and the Cheetos and toothpicks, that's Crispin. And that even at that age, I'm sure he said, pardon me, I have an idea and I would like to try it in this scene. You know that wasn't them. That's him all the way. That's just him. Oh,
do I believe that Chuck Zito came armed with a lot of fun character quirks for the people in this movie? No, I do not.
Well, I believe that Ted was written to have a teddy bear with him. So I think that that Crispin felt that Jimmy needed a little colorful, yes, aspect to his character.
Yep.
So he didn't have a prop. He needed a prop, so he made himself a prop.
We've talked about Jimmy's dance. I mean, it's probably the most famous thing from the movie. I think I'm standing by my evaluation that it's an interpretive movement version of Lucy's Chocolate Factory sketch. But he could also be landing a lot of airplanes very quickly.
Yeah.
I'm not particularly sure, but it is rhythmic, it is joyous, it does seem genuine, and it is super fucking weird. And no one else in that party seems to go, well, that's an odd thing to do. They're just like, that's how Jimmy dances.
I think they've accepted that he's an alien wearing human skin.
Yeah.
And is still trying to learn Earth's customs.
Here's the thing about that moment that really struck me watching it, because obviously I've heard about the dance. When it happens, I couldn't help but think, as it so often happens on movie sets, you're not watching the first take. You're probably not watching the second or third or fourth take. That's like the fifth or sixth time that Crispin was asked to do that. And it doesn't even look a little bit like he thought about it. Like, he's tired. It feels as sporadic. The other thing is, it seems a little aggressive. Like, it seems like, yeah, he's got a little anger behind it, just subtly. But it's wonderful. It really is as wonderful as, you know, you anticipate things in this life where you've been told that something's going to be special, and then most things don't live up to their reputation, but that certainly does.
I totally buy that it took multiple takes, and yet I would bet actual cash money that every take there was a different dance.
Absolutely, for sure.
So a whole bunch of drama happens. Everyone else in the party seems to be attending a wake, who isn't interacting with Tina. Tina and Paul have this interaction, and then Paul says, no, I can't sleep with one half of this murderous British duo. And I'm going to take off. And immediately Tina is prompted by her twin sister to walk over to the next available penis and jump on it. And that is Jimmy and not Ted. And then we get this crazy slow dance scene between the two of them to this horrible 30s song.
Yeah, they're listening. Yeah. For some reason, I don't know, this cabin is stocked entirely in stuff from the 1920s.
Yeah.
Like that's
and,
all the music
and
they
one
have.
Hair
then,
metal
then they have all the
album.
Then they have all the old like naughty movies.
60mm print of yeah, pornography from the '20s.
Like, you know, people dancing in their bloomers and all, and, yeah. And it's like this is somebody's great grandparents' summer cabin.
It does seem very to be sweet. Stocked with some odd shit. That's for damn sure. Although when I went to Spain, the rental place that we had for a week out in the middle of nowhere, we happened to discover the craziest shit. This guy had this one statue where if you pressed the guy's feet, his coat would open and his penis would become erect.
Statue? Like an actual statue?
A fucking statue.
How do I get one of those?
I don't know. I don't know where it came from. I have a picture. Wow. I will put it up on the Facebook page for everyone to see.
That's so great. Please
just so
tag
you
me.
Know I'm not lying.
Wow.
This fucking existed. So God, there's always weird shit in cabins. I remember one cabin that Becky and I went to in either Big Bear or Lake Arrowhead where it was just all evil clown pictures.
Well,
like straight out of my bedroom from when I was 5. It fucking freaked me out. They were all cross-stitched and they were all looking at me like, I don't like you. So Jimmy and Tina have this slow dance and the dialogue goes as such. I thought you wanted to be with Ted, Jimmy says, as he's wearing Paul's hat. Why is he asking about Ted? And Tina replies, well, I did. Now I want to be with you. And Jimmy's response is, that makes me feel like a rat. The whole time you've been complaining to Ted that you want to sleep with any twin that you can get near. You finally have one, and he's like, oh, all right. He's almost talking his way out of having sex.
Yeah.
I think that may be what Ted is trying to get through to him earlier, but because Ted's such an asshole, he just puts a complex into his head that he's a dead fuck, when really he should say, stop talking so much and just romance these people.
Well, you really want to hear after you ask, oh, well, I thought you wanted this person. Well, I did, but now I want you. That's a good ego stroke. It's like, yeah, it didn't work out. This other person that I was, you know, schmoozing all over 15 minutes ago. Now I'll just move on to you. You'll do.
His cock is the designated survivor of this particular party.
It reminded me that the era that I went to high school in was a constant reminder that I missed the part where people actually did dirty things like that. Like, oh, it doesn't matter. Whatever, now I'm going to sleep with you. I somehow missed the era where people behaved like that and girls just would switch and then you would... The guy wasn't available, so you were the next guy. I don't know what was going on in 1984 that made that possible, but I guess it was really still kind of the end of the 70s, huh?
Yeah. I mean, this first sequence of Friday the 13th movies really feel like the 70s, and then... With this one in particular, it hits hard 80s.
Yeah.
Like, all of a sudden, someone at Paramount are like, do you know that Ronald fucking Reagan is in office? Put some cap sleeves on these motherfuckers. So, Jimmy and Tina totes do it.
Yeah, the Jimmy losing his virginity is a large plot point in this movie. I've been wanting to bring this up. I find the way he behaves immediately following his deflowering to be a bit troubling and implausible. Now, I'm not going to get into anything personal, but I don't know how many people, even young men, will immediately upon losing their virginity, will exit the room without their pants on, go downstairs, and present their friend with the underwear of the person they just slept with.
I wondered about that.
That's really weird.
Yeah, agreed.
And I was watching it, and the way Ted was handling it, I'm like, oh my god, he's going to put it on his head. Oh my god, he's going to smell them, isn't he? Thank god. I mean, you could tell he was thinking about it. And I was like, please cut away. Please, thank you. Thank you for cutting away from that. But
I guarantee you there's a take where he puts it on his head. I guarantee you there's a take where he sniffs it.
I mean,
you can just feel it.
I mean, I think I might have written it in my diary, but I didn't make a point of announcing to the rest of the household, hey, guess what? It's just, it's very weird.
Yes. Well, we're entering a very distinct phase of this particular movie, and it's called noises off. It's all upstairs and downstairs, and wackiness abounds because Jason is somewhere and nowhere. He's everywhere all at once, and he doesn't have to make any noise when he walks past you. He knows what window you'll peer out of. It really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's sort of like...
And he can apparently scale the side of a building.
Yeah.
And with one, using one arm and using the other arm to fling someone out a window.
Well, yeah, like 5 days ago, he got a massive shoulder injury, Gina. I'm sure he could leap up that motherfucker, no problem. He just lifted Paul by his nutsack on the end of a spear gun. He is jacked. He's swole, and he doesn't care who knows it. It's weird how he just scatters about, and I wonder if this isn't an extension of something that Gina discovered very early on in our journey through the Friday the 13th series, and that is Jason has a superpower. And maybe it just goes through the entire Voorhees family, because I think you could extend it to Pamela. And that is that the Voorhees family knows a person's fuck style, just inherently. When he's in the zone, when he's near you, he can sense it.
Wow.
And therefore, he knows that Jimmy is the kind of person, even though this is the first time he's ever had sex, that afterwards, he's going to go downstairs and talk to the real love of his life.
Clearly.
To prove that he is, in fact, a real man. To which point, Ted is so high, not only in the realm of the movie, but actually in the filming of that scene, that he doesn't fucking care. Goes into the other room and grabs wine out of the refrigerator, pulls it out of there, and then loudly asks, as Gina has pointed out several times, with a continuously open mouth,
"Ted, where's the fucking corkscrew?" It's like, they sound like an old married couple.
It's the fancy corkscrew, which is even better, is that there's a corkscrew in the house that's not fancy. He does not want to use...
No.
The regular, he only wants to use the fancy.
No, this
corkscrew.
Is a special occasion shit, man. You need the fancy corkscrew.
So and good.
He receives that corkscrew right in his hand, nailing it down into some butcher block, which I might add, I think is impossible. I don't think that's the way corkscrews work.
They don't go
not
straight
the way
down.
He's
no.
Holding.
Sure.
No. But, I mean, okay, fine. It's, you know, it's a silly movie. It's a Tom Savini gag. That's not what I'm here to see. What I'm here to see is Tom's take on his hatchet head gag. This time, going into Jimmy's face. And say what you will, that is a cool kill.
Absolutely.
It just is.
It is, but it's very, it cuts away really quickly. Or at least the
that's
version.
That's an MPAA thing.
Yeah, the version.
Oh, is that why?
The version I watched, it was like barely a second, which for such a memorable character, he gets taken out pretty quickly.
Yeah. It's interesting that it's an MPAA thing and it makes sense. It really makes it effective, though. It's all the kills that are super effects heavy. Happened so fast that I was surprised at how elegantly they play, and they don't, you know, they don't feel dated at all. Mm-hmm. And that's really impressive, really, considering how old the film is.
One of the reasons I wanted to do this was that there's a little bit of a old school magic to it. The in-camera special gore effect has a bit of, you know, now you see it, now you don't. It's all about what you can get away with.
Yep.
You know, using the camera effectively to create an illusion. And once again, you're the only one of us who's really done gore effects on camera. How difficult is it to pull something like that off?
Crazy difficult. And even when you have a substantial budget, you know, which I haven't really, but compared to, you know, tiny, tiny movies that have pulled it off very successfully, and you can build a dummy and do all kinds of cool pneumatic, you know, head popping off devices and stuff, it still only can play for a matter of frames before you just, your brain knows that it's not a person's body. That fall is, am I jumping ahead too much?
You can jump ahead. We'll
circle
back.
That fall is amazing. Is that a body? Is that a dummy? Is that a real person?
That is a real person.
It's so well done. It's so well done. It's so beautiful.
And it adds so much production value to this.
Yeah.
To see a real stunt adds yeah. so much production value.
I know.
Because you can tell, like, you can tell that's not the same person, but that's fine. But the way that impact goes and the way the windows blow out when Tina actually hits that car, it's fucking just as good as the fall in Lethal Weapon. In yep. my mind, it's just as good. And the additional part is to it, the Lethal Weapon one's a flat smack.
Right.
Whereas this one, she bounces off the top of the car and rolls off onto the side. It just makes it worse. Like, it's not planned. It just doesn't feel like this is a planned stunt. Like, that yeah. went well.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody got a little hurt doing that, and somehow you can feel that while that's happening.
Well, the crazy thing is about that take that we see, that's the second take.
Wow.
They did several takes of her being thrown out. They just would catapult her, and the stuntman would kind of appear to be throwing her. But the impact into the top of the station wagon, they did that twice. And wow. what we see is take number two.
Wow.
So the whoever did that stunt, man, all of my hats are off to you. You are a legend. So let's circle back very quickly. Jimmy, RIPD, let's talk about Tina. And then we'll talk about their amazing death scene again. The thing that came across to me this time about Tina is that she sticks her fucking finger in the dip to try it out, which is gross. I don't care what country you're from. She is from another country. She is a guest here. Don't stick your finger in dip to try it out. That's just not okay. In the last episode, we talked about Paul's Three Stooges impression. When he's asked to be kissed by his girlfriend, he says, "Certainly." And we surmised that would instantly dry up any woman he's around. This time, we get Tina's little rascal-esque sideways hat crowning during her slow dance. No one knows how to do hat business in this movie.
Truly.
Yeah, a lot of them kind of come off like they just stepped off the mothership into this cabin in the woods, and that they're all trying to hide the fact from each other that they're aliens. It's like, this could have turned into The Thing if it was written a different way. You know, you've got Tommy and you've got Trish. You know,
no, Trish is the sister.
Yeah.
Trish is Terry.
I meant Trish, though. Tommy and Trish are sitting, you know, outside the burning wreck of their house, just kind of staring at each other. You know, what should we do now? Why don't we just wait a little while, see what happens? Friday the 13th, part 4. Because they all sort of act a little weird, and I don't buy that any of these people, except maybe for Ted and Jimmy, ever met each other before this trip. There's just there's a very weird dynamic to, and again, it is made weirder by the old timey music and the old timey nudie movies they find. And have they all already been dead the whole time?
Definitely sure. Got a Waiting for Godot quality in this film, doesn't it?
Yeah, like I fully support the idea that being stuck in the Pine Barrens of New Jersey would be a lot like what purgatory would be like. I went to high school around there, so I just create a fan theory. They are all been dead the whole time.
Sure, why not? In the lead up to Tina's amazing demise, she looks out one window, sees that her and Terry's bike are still there. So now she's on the lookout for Terry. She then goes to the other window in the room and looks out once, then comes back, looks out again, then comes back and looks out a third time. And I know that Chuck Zito is thinking that he's building suspense in this sequence, but I would say this is the one definite time that he's just stretching. Like,
yeah.
We gotta get to 90 minutes. There's no way it was scripted that she looks out a window not once, not twice, but three times, and that's on top of the one time she looked out a different window. And then Jason reaches through, she's defenestrated. Through the window and onto the top of that station wagon, and that window in the back that Ted and Jimmy stick their heads out of in the beginning of the movie is blown to bits. It's unfortunate, but it sure does look cool to watch. So we once again reach that golden moment in every episode. It's everyone's favorite. It's the game that's sweeping the nation. It's choose your own death venture. And so our odds are kind of in everyone's favor here. We got three selections. There's three of us. we can double up though. So choose with your heart. I ask you, Gina Radcliffe, you're going first. Do you want to blink out into nothingness like Mrs. Jarvis? Do you want a corkscrew in the hand and meat cleaver in the face like Jimmy? Or do you want to be pulled out of a second story window and hit a station wagon in the coolest fucking stunt I've ever seen in a Friday the 13th movie?
When you put it that Mrs. Jarvis blinks out of existence, I sort of picture her putting on the One Ring. And so sure. You know, that seems like kind of a cool way to go. So
that's really addictive, though, Gina. You're stepping into a big responsibility slapping on that ring. You know what happens to people when they do that?
On the other hand, I could get flung out a window or get a hatchet to the face. I mean, you know, at least the thing that happens with the One Ring, it takes place over a period of time. But on the other hand, she's just this very forgettable character, and I don't want to be forgotten. So I'm actually going to go ahead and I will say I'm going to take Jimmy's way out. Corkscrew to the hand, hatchet to the face. That's one of the most memorable, despite it not being as long on screen as I remember seeing it before, it's still probably the most memorable one in the movie, to me anyway.
I would agree with that. Okay, our guest, Jeremy, sir, do you choose?
I gotta say, I love Crispin's death in this movie. I think it's beautifully done. I think the expression on his face when he gets the hatchet in the face is gorgeous and everything it should be. But I am just a huge fan of that Italian giallo Suspiria shit and that fling in slow motion balletically coming out the window with the glass flying and the bounce on the car and the windows blowing out. It's just, it's so over the top and wonderful. I would have to pick that.
I am going to side with Jeremy on this for this reason. I was a big fan of the stunt guy growing up. I watched a lot of A-Team. I watched a lot of people get their feet shot at on TV.
Sure.
And because you couldn't show actual violence. So everyone's feet got shot at. And that kind of stunt, there's something about it that just hits my 9-year-old button. Like,
yeah.
Joy! And I love that stunt. I love it. If I weren't Agreed. Already married, I might be ring shopping right now. I'm telling you. It's really cool.
It's a good one.
Oh, note to self, do not play for Becky. Okay. And so that brings us to the end of yet another episode. Hey, Jeremy, where can people find out more about you and what's happening?
Well, I have a website right on the World Wide Web on the tubes of the internet. And that's jeremycaston.com. And of course, you know, my movies are available on Amazon and all the other wonderful places like Netflix. And just out there on the World Wide Web.
Yeah, they're all great. I'm a fan of all of them. I would throw it out there. Attic Expeditions is a joy to behold. It is.
Oh, thank you.
It is my favorite of yours by hair, but it is a definitive favorite. I love it. It's trippy. It's so weird. It has such a wonderful voice. If you have not seen Attic Expeditions, by God, watch it today. Oh, hey, Gina, where can people find you on the internet?
How am I supposed to follow up with that? I've not made any movies.
That's true, but you've made things. You have a voice and you say it loud and proud. What do you want to speak about? We say your name.
You could not sound more patronizing right now, I have to say. Oh no! You have something to contribute? Really? Tell them what you do. It's okay. Well, Patrick,
note
if you must
self,
know.
Don't play this back for Gina, okay?
I write about 70s and 80s television at tuneintonight.wordpress.com.
Hooray!
Excellent. Wow. Hey, check it out, people. Alrighty. If you want to talk to us, there's a couple ways you can do it. You can email us at killbykillpod@gmail.com or reach out to us on Twitter. Several of you have been doing that lately, and it's been wonderful. @killbykillpod. If you have a moment, please rate and review us on iTunes. I'll tell you what, when you rate and review us on iTunes, tell us what your favorite kill is from the Friday the 13th series. And we'll read it on the air. That is my promise to you. I will bring up your statement of your favorite kill from Friday the 13th on air. Please rate and review us today. Speak from your heart. And we will praise your name as well. That will do it for today. Until next time, people, that's Kill by Kill. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Bye, guys.
Kill by Kill is produced by We Write Good and is intended for entertainment purposes only. Friday the 13th is owned by Paramount Pictures. Jason is owned by New Line Cinema. No infringement is intended. Kill by Kill logo was designed by Josh Hollis. Visit him at joshhollis.com. The Kill by Kill theme was created exclusively for us by Revenge Body. Get the whole track and much, much more at revengebodymemphis.bandcamp.com today.